Lech lecha, meyartzecha, mimoledecha, vibeit avicha. 7 years ago, we started on a journey, that ongoing journey, to discuss the key issues confronting us in the modern world. And while perhaps we're not lech lecha to Eretz Yisrael, we try to bring Eretz Yisrael here, ki mitzion teitzei Torah. And it's been a pleasure over the years to bring some of the leading thinkers in the modern Orthodox religious Zionist world to address us. And, of course, this weekend we'll have an opportunity to hear five of our seven speakers actually live in Israel. And the rest of us are here to get the Torah from Eretz Yisrael. So it's a pleasure. It's hard to believe this is our seventh year already. And we want to thank you for your help and support for making it possible and giving us the encouragement to keep growing. Michael Ochayel. I just want to say a few thank yous. I want to thank our host, the Sher Shemaim congregation, its rabbi, Rav Strachler, the president, Charlene RJ, the board, the entire congregation for welcoming Torah in Motion into their midst. As I'm sure many of you know, we do a lot of our programs here, and it's really, we want to thank the shul for their help. We also want to thank the shuls. Okay. We want to thank the shuls that helped make this weekend not just a Saturday night program, but B'nai Torah Associated in Archaim, who hosted speakers over Shabbat. If you missed it, it's too late, but of course there'll be opportunities in the future, so we want to thank them as we spread over Shabbat. Thank you to Larry and Sarah Krause, who once again are sponsoring our Renewing Our Spirit Conference. This is the seventh year of their sponsorship, the seventh year of our conference, and we thank them. Larry has yahrzeit for his father, who unfortunately passed away as a young man at this time of year, Nathan Nutta Krause, and we thank them for the sponsorship, and we should be able to celebrate happy occasions for many years to come. I want to thank our technical support. They don't get enough thanks. Shalom Eisenstadt, who has worked... I mentioned before, our E-team, it's really the brainchild of Shalom and the hours and hours that he has put in, doing all kinds of technical support that I know nothing about. I want to thank him, and of course, David Callender, without him, we wouldn't have all our hundreds of MP3s, and the work he does behind the scenes, I want to thank him in public, acknowledge him. We did mention, One complaint we often hear at of Renewing Our Spirit is, why do you always have competing speakers at the same time? We always have to choose. So, okay, that's the way it goes in life. You have to make, choices. So in order to make it a little bit easier, we said that anybody who comes this evening can have, and tomorrow, free MP3s of the whole conference. If you read my emails, you would have known that already, but okay. That's too much to expect. So if you'd like your free MP3, send an email to techsupport@torahinmotion.org. That's all you have to do. TECH, techsupport@torahinmotion.org. Just write free MP3s in the title, and by Wednesday, approximately, give or take a week, you'll have the MP3s. Okay, without further ado, it's really a pleasure. Elliot is really the master of the programming and the, his insightful and incisive, questions and handling. It's really a pleasure for me, and I really want to, of course, we work together and all the work, and I really want to thank him for everything that he does, and I'll let him take over. And for the rest of the evening, and yasher koach, and hope you sit back, enjoy, and we'll speak to you later. Thank you.
Good evening. Is Jewish unity a myth? Benedict Spinoza seemed to feel that the only thing that kept the Jewish people together was anti-Semitism, and in the absence of Jew hatred, Jews would fall apart as a unified entity. And it does seem that Jews argue about everything, and seem to be only briefly united by the simplest propositions, such as, in our time, remember the 6 million, or by outbreaks of anti-Semitism, or threats existentially to Israel. As we all know, that's a very undesirable ground for unity, a threat from the outside. I brought these gentlemen together this evening to talk about the rifts in Jewry in our time and what it is that we can do to mark the way forward. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce them to you. On this end, Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein is the Director of Interfaith Affairs of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. Rabbi Adlerstein also holds the Sidney M. Ermis Adjunct Chair in Jewish Law and Ethics at Loyola Law School and teaches at the Yeshiva University High Schools in Los Angeles. He's well known to people who read Jewish journals, Jewish Action, as well as many essays in the regular press, Los Angeles Times, National Law Review, First Things, Tradition, and so on. He's often quoted in the media, both in Southern California and nationally, and is a co-founder of Cross Currents, a blog of Torah and current affairs. Immediately to my right, Dr. Yoel Finkelman, who in addition to teaching at Midrashet Lindenbaum, is the director of projects and research at Atid, which is a Jerusalem foundation that works to develop educational leadership. Dr. Finkelman received his PhD from the Department of Jewish Thought at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and has published in journals such as Modern Judaism, Jewish Political Studies Review, and the Torah Umada Journal. To my left, Michael Broyd. Rabbi Broyd is professor of law at Emory University Law School and the academic director of the Law and Religion program at that university. His primary areas of interest are law and religion, Jewish law and ethics, and he has taught many courses in law, federal courts, alternative dispute resolution, and so on. He's also the founding rabbi of the Young Israel of Atlanta and has published numerous articles on various aspects of law and religion, both in Jewish and in general journals. On the far end is Rabbi Benny Lau. Rabbi Lau is the director of the Center for Judaism and Society, as well as the Institute for Social Justice at Beit Morashah in Jerusalem. Rabbi Lau also serves as the rabbi of the Ramban Synagogue in the Katamon neighborhood of Jerusalem. He lectures on halakha and social justice at Beit Morashah's Robert M. Barron College and also at Bar-Ilan University. He studied at Har Etzion and the yeshiva of the Kibbutz HaDati and was awarded an MA and PhD from Bar-Ilan. Earlier this year, in late April, early May, Israel's Supreme Court, Rabbinic Court, headed by Rabbi Avram Sherman, issued a 50-page legal verdict that included the following statement. Quote, first, a conversion performed by Rabbi Chaim Avior and Rabbi Chaim Druckmann must be disqualified. Second, conversions can be retroactively annulled for those who are not observant, end quote. In the wake of this decision, besides many arguments about the correctness of the ruling per se, there were heated discussions about whether it would contribute to a final and irrevocable split within Orthodox Judaism, especially in the land of Israel, not to mention the question of how Orthodoxy would once again be perceived in non-Orthodox circles. One of the members of this panel, Rabbi Lau, in commenting on the ultra-Orthodox community, had this to say, and I quote directly, "The fate of the state of Israel does not appear on their radar. They do not send their sons into the line of fire. They do not send their daughters to perform national service. They make a living off charity and refuse to take part in shouldering the burden of the Jewish people. We must free Israel and establish religious services and religious courts that are fundamentally identified with the values of the country in which they operate," end quote. Rabbi Lau, I'm going to begin with you, but I'm going to ask for everyone on the panel to comment in turn. Your words that I've just quoted are, it's not the language of compromise or negotiation, but it's rather the language of either or, either us or them, but not us and them together in an amachat, one people. Do you feel, based on what you're saying, that a split within Orthodoxy is now inevitable and irreversible? And if so, what has happened to the value of one Jewish people, of Klal Yisrael? And lastly, is there no method or means to begin to quietly bridge the differences between religious Jews of all stripes?
Shavu Tov. We have an old tradition, Am Yisrael, around the world. It's a real chashuv minhag that in Motzei Shabbatot we need to speak just a positive and really to keep the idea of Eliyahu Navi sit in his place and count the zchuyot of Am Yisrael. And I want to keep myself in this evening to behave, follow this minhag, trying to deal with the question, not to run from it, but with it, with this limited, and to understand the differences between fighting against people who stand in a position of leadership and do nothing of their achrayut, responsibility, and looking to the other side, not to the leaders, but to the people, without any difference between Haredi, secular, Ashkenazi, Sfaradi, without any difference. You will forgive me about my English. It's a regular Israeli high school. Not less, not more. But this, in Hebrew, you said, Ze ma sheyesh. Zeu. I apologize. When I wrote this column, it was immediately after the terrible, terrible psak din written by few Haredim sitting in the chairs of Dayanim in the officially Bet Din of the State of Israel. I want to say that it was a shame that psak din like this public in the world. It was not just chilul Hashem. It wasn't just rishut to write words against thousand people who complete the whole process of giyur, the conversion, in the last 30 years. People who build families, kids, grandchildren, and by like this, write psak din, trying to cancel, to rid them off the Jewish family. I want to say something using words coming from the Gemara Yerushalmi, from Rabbi Meir Balanes, who all his life tried to kept his teacher named Acher, Elisha ben Avuya, that ran far away from the Jewish tradition because many reasons. You all know the stories about Elisha ben Avuya. But the Yerushalmi said that even after Elisha ben Avuya died, after that, students came to Rabbi Meir and told him that they see fire in the kever of Elisha ben Avuya. They see fire. Meant to say that Hashem punished him after die. Yerushalmi Masechet Chagiga, said that Rabbi Meir went to the cemetery, took off his talit, and start cover the kever with his talit on the fire, stood and said, he used the words from Megillat Rut. Sometimes I think maybe it happened in around Chag HaShavuot, Matan Torah. He used the word that Boaz said in the very interesting evening to Rut. When she came overnight, she came to him, to his place, and Boaz said to Ruth, please stay here overnight, lini po alayla, sleep here overnight, v'ayab boker, let's see what will happen in the morning. We know, said Boaz, that there is someone in the world closer than me. It's called the Goel. Someone needs to take achrayut on you before me. Vehaya. Im yigalech tov yigal. If he will do his duty, excellent. And then Boaz said, if not, if he will not do his duty, I swear, say Boaz, egalech anochi chai Hashem. I will do it, I promised, I swear. This is the pasuk in Megillat Rut. Rabbi Meir stood on the fire and said, to whom? He said to Hashem, Lini po alayla, the soul of my Rebbe, Elisha ben Avuya, you should be in rest. You should be quiet. Lini po alayla, stay here. Vaya im yigalech. He, if he will take responsibility and do his duty, Baruch Hashem, excellent. But if not, I swear, egalech anochi, I will not let him rid of you. I will take achrayut to put you inside the souls of Am Israel. This is Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes after Elisha ben Avuya died. And I want to say that when we are talking about Am Israel, about Klal Israel, about Achdut Israel, we cannot stop these acts of saying we are the clothed people. If the people with the keys, the Dayanim, the Rabbanim, I don't care who, the people who run the offices, the Batei Din, the special Batei Din to the Giyur, the Kashrut, the Rabbanut, if they do their job to collect the souls of Am Israel, I will say Baruch Hashem. But I want to say loudly, I am saying it in Eretz Israel, in Medinat Israel, I will say it here. We have responsibility to each one of Am Israel, even if he is not a real Jew. He is Zera Israel. He came because the law of return that raised to the world after Nuremberg laws. This is achrayut of Klal Israel. And we have the responsibility. And we will stand like Boaz, like Rabbi Meir, and we will say, Im yigalech tov, v'im lo yigalech, egalech anochi, chai Hashem.
I'm a little confused. They told me that I was going to a vision at Sir Tish. I think I stumbled on the wrong event.
I grew a beard.
But as long as we're talking about Vizhnitz, Rabbi Yisrael Vizhnitzer has a beautiful vart. You won't remember it by Pesach, but the night before Pesach, we go around the house, we do Bedikat Chametz. The next morning, we take the chametz, we take the nair, we take the feather. We take the spoon, and we burn it all. And it sounds intuitive. Anything that is chametz or related to chametz, we have to rid ourselves of. Ask Rav Yisrael Vizhnitzer. Makes sense for the chametz. The spoon, the feather, but why the candle? The candle never comes in contact with the chametz. If it does, we're in trouble with the fire department. Why do we burn that too? Said Rabbi Yisrael Vizhnitzer, the function of bedikat chametz, according to many of our svarim, is to root out what chametz stands for. The aveirot, the faults, the sins, the shortcomings of Klal Yisrael. The nair has one function. It's there to spy out, to look for the dirt, to look for the problems. Said Rav Yisrael Vizhnitzer, anything whose sole function is to look for the faults of Klal Yisrael, that should be burnt too. I am going to resist the temptation to do a point-by-point refutation or discussion with Rabbi Lau on some of the fault lines that he's brought up. I will say that I disagree categorically with his depiction both of the Psak Halacha. I am a member of a standing Bet Din Legiur in California. The notion of invalidating Geirut is not a new one. It's been on the books. It's a halachic issue. There were many things about this Psak that I also found disturbing, and so did everyone else who looked at it. But in the end, these are halachic issues that have to be addressed halachically, and I'm not sure that this is the forum. I disagree categorically with Rabbi Lau's depiction of the Haredi community. I am not here as an apologist for the Haredi community. If I were, they would probably have slashed my tires before getting here. I think they have more able apologists. But much of what Rabbi Lau says is true, but that's not the way Haredim see themselves. It is not true that they don't see themselves as having achrayut. You may not like the way they translate that feeling into reality. You may disagree with every single detail of it, but it is not true that they don't think that they have responsibility. They think that their tefillot, that their learning, that their lifestyle is a manifestation of that achrayut. That much credit they should be given. Let's get down to the main tenor of the question that brings us here. I urge all of us to understand that there are differences between the situation in Eretz Yisrael and the situation that confronts us here in the West. Most people I know would agree with Rabbi Lau's RX, his prescription for what has to happen. I know of very, very few people who are happy with the Israeli rabbinate and agree that there must be some kind of rabbinate that presents a different face to Israelis, especially secular Israelis. But the general issue of whether there should be a clean break, whether there should be a differentiation between two communities, I beg you, Rabbi Lau, don't export what may be an Israeli problem to the West. The very fact that we are all sitting together in this room, that people of very different stripes and colors, all kinds of colors and your basic black, are invited here by Torah in Motion, can get together, can reason with each other. We have a different set of realities here. We can get together, we do get together. The notion of austrit, of separating into two communities, which weighed so heavily on Rav Shamshon and Paul Hirsch in Germany in the 19th century, and was only resorted to because of deep-seated halachic issues, is not one that confronts us today. Our view should be to see how many bridges can remain open and how many more can be built. And I don't think that's so much of a problem. I also ask you to realize, please don't make the same mistake as the community you criticize. One of the things that you don't like about Haredim, many people don't, is that they seem to adopt, at times, many people do, a us and them, our road or the high road, we're the only ones who are right, not even looking at the other side. And that is to many people troubling, and the truth is it's self-defeating. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal, who I understand is a favorite son of this city, was once asked at a Torah Mesorah convention about teaching the science of antiquity in right-wing schools. Do you teach about dinosaurs? Do you teach about the world being billions of years old. And apparently today they don't listen. But back then, Rav Yaakov Zatzal said, I wish I could do this in Yiddish, but he said, so what's the alternative? You're not going to teach? And then some student will open the New York Times and he'll see on the front page the discovery of a fossil X number of million years old. And everybody knows if it's in the New York Times, it has to be true. What is he going to think about everything that he was taught? If you don't expose your students to truth on the other side, to the vantage point of the other side, you're going to get in trouble when they find things in the other community that they like. This is a problem for the Haredi community when in some cases, in some schools, they are taught that everybody on the other side is a shagitz and a frum, and then they find that they're wonderful people who they like even better than their own community. But don't make the same mistake. There are parts of the Haredi community that your children and grandchildren, as well as yourselves, are gaining from every day, are major points of strength that they are going to see the beauty of. And if you devalue that and you tell them that that is another group and we don't believe in that, when they find things that they like, they're going to be left with a contradiction. What we have to do is find ways, as hard as it is, to identify the strong points of all communities and have all of our children be comfortable with all of them.
In Atlanta, Georgia, where I come from, I try to express the goals of what I envision with two phrases that are almost a mantra. And those who know me know I'm not into mantras. The first is unity without uniformity, and the second is diversity without divisiveness. And when we seek to craft a structure of Jewish unity, is it a myth? I think the answer is that unity is easy to achieve on some theoretical level if we insist that it comes with uniformity. But we all recognize that none of us are in fact interested in a united Jewish community that's also uniform. Because I'd be very happy if Orthodoxy was absolutely united and uniformly in agreement with me. And each and every one of you in the audience, I suspect, feels the exact same way, if only you could persuade everybody to be like you. The problems come up when we seek to craft communities that are united but not uniform. And this is the real challenge confronting us. And I want to pick up on a remark that Rabbi Adlerstein said, because I think it's very telling. When he commented on if he came here as a Haredi spokesman, they would slash his tires. And I think, in fact, that if there is a single criticism to be voiced of the Haredi community, he voiced it, which is we don't want to be part of a community of tire slashers. And that the problem isn't the value of the Haredi community. It's their absolute and complete insistence that all other voices have to be squashed, and their comfortableness in resorting to unethical and illegal activity to squash them. And I don't think Rabbi Adlerstein was kidding when he said they'd slash his tires. I think they'd throw rocks.
I was kidding.
I don't think he is, actually.
I just want to say that we will buy you new tires.
If you persist in saying that, Michael, I'm going to slash your tires.
The problem I have is we have sometimes developed a culture in which each and every one of us insists that our view is correct. And, which is fine, all of us in our heart of hearts believe our views are correct. But then we decide we're going to resort to methods to persuade people of the correctness of our religious view that becomes at its end coercive. And I, by the way, sit on a Beis Din LeGiur, and Rabbi Adlerstein's comments about the Pesach, I think, are correct. What do I mean by that? Rabbi Sharman's view represents a reasonable view. What's wrong with the decision isn't anything about the technical halachic decision. Perhaps it goes to a much harder comment, which is once you have a chief rabbinate and you have an official determination of Jewishness from the state, inevitably desires to create unity have to coalesce around uniformity. Because if there is a definition of Jewishness for the government of Israel, there can only be one. And once there can only be one, then we have to agree on a definition, and then we have to coerce people to obey our definition. Were Rabbi Sharman's psak coming out of a Beis Din of Vizhnitz in Borough Park, we wouldn't mind. Those of us who would choose to follow it would follow it. And those of us who would choose not to follow it would choose not to follow it. So what I find very complicated here is those of us who are religious Zionists, and I comfortably count myself in that community, have historically adopted the view that what we want is a centralized chief rabbinate. We just want it to be our centralized chief rabbinate. And we, in fact, fell victim exactly to what Rabbi Adlerstein decried, which is we went around coercing people to follow our vision of Torah. And we grabbed hold of the organs of state, and we pressed people through our grasping of the organs of state to obey our vision of halacha. We've now more or less lost control of the chief rabbinate. And now, you know what has happened? Other people are doing the exact same thing that we did for decades, and we're discovering, you know what? It hurts. Didn't hurt when we did it, by the way, but it hurts when it's done to us. And that's a very fascinating take-home message. America has never suffered from this problem, and the Jewish community is much more united precisely because there is no hierarchical structural authority in America. There is no coercion, not just because the secular government won't let us, but because we've structured our communities around a non-hierarchical rabbinate, where in the typical shul, there's the rabbi in charge of the shul, and you want to know who's in charge of the rabbi? Maybe the board of directors, maybe not. And the way people show their dislike of the decisions the rabbi makes is they go to a different shul. Or they fire the rabbi, whatever exactly the construct is. There's no higher organization above the local rabbi. And what has happened thus in America is unity is achieved with the ground rule understanding that there can never be any uniformity. And that structure has created a very different model of Orthodox Jewry in many different flavors, and by the way, very different models of conservative and reform Jewry, also in many, many, many different flavors. So I want to suggest to you three things, and they're all somewhat despondent. If you want hierarchical rabbinical authority, like the chief rabbinate in Israel, it's because you genuinely believe that the values of unity plus uniformity are proper. And then you can't complain when you lose control of the chief rabbinate and that institution that you used to squeeze others is now used to squeeze you. Or you can opt for the American model, in which there is absolutely no hierarchical rabbinical authority to speak of. And then you live in a community where unity is easily achieved because it doesn't matter, because nobody really is in charge, And the ground rules of Jewish life in the United States are very synagogue-centered, with every individual rabbi deciding the tone, texture, and tempo of his own relatively small community. The third problem, of course, is perhaps the hardest, which is, in the last 20 years, we've seen orthodoxy in all of its permutations grow a tad too fanatical, and more comfortable resorting to vicious ad hominems, or even the use of physical force to persuade people not to dissent. And to me, of all the things that needs to be decried, opposed, is the problem of goons or thugs in our society, and this is certainly true in Israel, and to some extent true in the United States as well, where you begin to develop a society where people are afraid to express their views because dissent produces tire slashing. Dissent produces yeshiva students going around throwing rocks. Dissent produces picketing. Dissent produces all sorts of complex physical phenomena, or even simply vicious name-calling. So I think the future of Israel is probably more heading into the model of the United States, which is without a chief rabbinic, and then it'll have the problems associated with a completely flat rabbinic authority. It will create much more Jewish unity, having completely forsaken the ability to create any uniformity. Shavuot Tov.
Right on that cheerful note, I'm not sure whether what I've jotted down to say right now is actually any different from what Rabbi Broid has said, only perhaps in slightly different language. But I would like to. I don't claim to be an expert either on the current conversion crisis. Certainly not in its halachic aspects. So I want to preface what I'm about to say, to be a little bit of a preface. It's not clear to me what we mean by Jewish unity, meaning I don't know what Jewish unity would look like if I saw it. As Rabbi Broidy said, certainly we do not mean uniformity. Certainly it would include some measure of pluralism. It would include some measure of tolerance. It would include some measure of intolerance in the sense that Jewish unity would have to be a unity of some kind of distinctive parts. The question uses a language of irrevocable split. And again, even there, I'm not quite sure what that means. Is there an irrevocable split in Israeli Orthodoxy between Haredim and modern Orthodox, between the conservative movement in America and the Orthodox movements in America? There is some underlying sense of people belonging to something that is mishutaf, that is joint, and there is an underlying sense of being in a vastly different place. And I'm not sure at what point we have gone off the deep end of an irrevocable split, and at what point we're looking at something that is in the realm of tolerance and in the realm of pluralism that would have to be part of.
I'm going to give you an example right now. Okay, in 1983, the Reform Movement put out a decision of patrilineal lineage.
At a
certain point, it's not my way, your way. That's an irrevocable split. Either person walking in the room is Jewish in your opinion or is not Jewish in your opinion. Not sort of pregnant, but yay or nay. So there are things that are actually aligned.
I'll get to that in a second. Another thing that I think mixes into the mix here, certainly in America, less so in Israel, although to a great degree in Israel as well, is that we live in a modern society with a fair measure of freedom of religion, and Judaism is whatever a group of Jews can convince themselves that it is. And if, as far as I am concerned, Kashrut has something to do with the Shulchan Aruch if there are a group of Jews centered, not surprisingly, in California, who think that kashrut has to do with sustainable growth and paying migrant workers a living wage. I'm all for paying migrant workers a living wage. There is, not only don't they care whether I don't like their definition of kashrut, they don't ask, and I have little way of doing anything about it. The intriguing, or the issue that has been raised front and center in terms of the conversion crisis is exactly, it seems to me, the place where this kind of explodes. Because as far as I can tell, there are two issues about which we're going to get into an irrevocable split that Dr. Malamud was mentioning. And one of those issues is calendar. If at some point a Jewish group would have Pesach on different days, would have Shabbat on different days, would measure the calendar differently, then I think, at least if history teaches us anything, that's a point at which we have an irrevocable split. And the other point is, I don't think theoretically whether or not the person who walks into the room is Jewish, not Jewish, pregnant, not pregnant, the question of whether we will marry each other is the point at which you get into a irrevocable split of an entirely different kind. And that is why the conversion, current conversion crisis, both in terms of the Haredi attempt, whether it's individuals or whether it's a question of policy, whether it's deliberate or accidental, but the Haredi attempt to impose standards retroactively on a community that does not identify with those standards. So here is a situation where we are playing with fire, and also in terms of the chief rabbinate's attempt to impose its standards on the United States, on the United States rabbinate, and to a fair degree, I want to be cautious about this, but there is certainly a sense from what I've read in the media that to a great degree the American rabbinate has capitulated and allowed the Israeli rabbinate, whatever the details of the condition, that the chief rabbinate is in a position to veto who the American Orthodox rabbinate considers valid. Again, these are really issues that are playing with fire, because they're really touching on irrevocable split of a more serious kind. I'll take it even a step further to add to the pessimism that seems to be developing on this panel, and that is that it seems to me that it takes two people to make peace and one to make war. Meaning, it takes two sides with goodwill, two sides with an awareness of difference and a willingness to get along with each other to reach some kind of modus vivendi, to reach some kind of middle ground that will allow everybody some kind of tolerance, some kind of pluralism that will allow people to get along. But if one side is dedicated to a battle and imposing its conditions on the other, then war, to use an overstated metaphor perhaps, is inevitable, because one side cannot make peace unilaterally. And certainly my fear is that the long-term consequences of a Haredized Israeli chief rabbinate's attempt to impose its standards in terms of conversion, which ultimately translates into marriage and divorce, on both the Israeli sector and on the sector in Chutz La'aretz, is exactly the kind of thing that over the course of generations, perhaps over the course of hundreds of years, will look less like a split between Hasidim and Mitnagdim and more like a split between rabbinic Jews and Sadducees. And that's frankly frightening.
I want to follow up with a halachic conversation, as they call a nitty-gritty conversation. There are many areas of halacha where there are diverse theoretical standards. We all know this. And I want to ask a thought question, which is, when does halacha impose standards that are designed to create unity and uniformity and not allow diversity to blossom? A classic example of this is gittin. It's exceptionally rare to find a Masader gittin anywhere that will issue a get that isn't valid everywhere. And we have a well-agreed-upon standard noted by the Marashtam and others that gittin achieve a high universal standard, and you shouldn't issue a get that's valid according to even the mainstream majority opinion if there's a significant dissent that disagrees. And the Ramah notes as well that that's the standard with building mikvaot. And it's only in emergency situations that you build a mikvah that's kosher according to most, but not all opinions. You build mikvaot that are kosher by all standards. It's not true, for example, for kashrut. I heard from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son, that his grandfather, who he's named for, Reb Chaim Mibrisk, felt the what they call the tarta l'reisa meat. The Shach notes a stricture in Yoredeya that meat that has two problems with it, both of which would be resolved leniently, independently, if they both arise, shouldn't be certified as kosher. And the practice in Brisk, under the Dayan of Brisk, Dayan Riegler, was not to certify the tarta l'reisa meat as kosher. And Reb Chaim Mibrisk felt that that was wrong. So he used to go to the butcher and buy the meat not certified kosher by the Dayan of Brisk and eat it in his house because it was cheaper, because it wasn't thought to be kosher. And here Reb Chaim Mibrisk would eat it, in return for which Hamonam, the normal people in Brisk, wouldn't eat in Reb Chaim's house because he didn't keep a high enough kosher standard. Ha ha! Meaning the form, what you could reasonably call the foremost halachic authority in Europe at the time, the normal people in his community thought he didn't keep kosher. And what did Reb Chaim think? He didn't care. He said there's no reason for a uniform kashrut standard. And we see this, by the way. We have diverse kashrut standards. We have diverse tefillah standards. We have diverse tefillin standards. We have uniform calendar standards. We have to ask ourselves, when is it that halacha calls upon us to place a high premium on everybody doing the same thing? It's not when it comes to food. It's not. It's not when it comes to tefillah. Anybody who's been around the world sees that minhagei tefillah are exceptionally diverse. It's not when it comes to choshen mishpat, financial matters. And by the way, it never was with regards to conversion. And I'll tell you why. Although it sounds terrible for one community to look at another community and say some of their members are Gentiles, in fact, it's a fixable problem. If I issue a get to a woman that you think is invalid, and she remarries and has children, those children are beautiful little mamzerim, whose status can't be fixed. And thus, we don't want to let people do that. But if I do conversions that another rabbi thinks are invalid, you know what he'll do? We have a term for it. It's called double dipping. Okay? He'll straight out of Baskin-Robbins, he will convert them a second time. And that's okay. We have no tradition, when you read through the responsa literature, of a rabbi saying, I have lower conversion standards, which I won't implement lest I disrupt Jewish unity, because if my standards are not your standards, you can reconvert them to meet your standards if they so wish. It's no different than many other areas of halacha where we recognize legitimate disputes. There's a dispute about whether pheasant is kosher. Some people eat it, some people don't. That's life. There's a dispute about whether the regular milk in the United States, and I assume Canada, is kosher. Some people rely on it, some people don't. That's life. There's a dispute about whether a woman whose father is a Gentile and whose mother is a Jew can marry a Kohen. And practical halacha l'maisa, there are diverse standards used in the community as to whether such a woman can marry a Kohen, and that's okay too. I want to suggest to you that you have to really ponder the question of when is it that halacha steps forward and says, no, no, no. Here's a case where even though more than one option is theoretically possible, in fact, we need to have a single standard. I'll tell you what I think the answer is. I think the answer is that when you're in a situation where you can't legitimately control who uses the activity and the mistake is irrevocable, we default to the highest standard. So for Gittin, we run a very high standard because the mistake, the problem is unfixable by a future rabbi who adheres to a different standard. By mikvaot, precisely because we don't know who uses the mikvah, and we can't put up disclaimers about you can use this mikvah only if, we default to the highest standard. By the calendar, we have no choice but to default to the highest standard. But as a general proposition, when somebody says to you, you know what we need here? We need just a single standard that everybody can follow. You should raise your hand and say, how come? I don't think that's the normal halachic answer to a dispute among the Rishonim. I don't think that's the normal answer to a dispute among the Achronim. I don't think that's the normal answer to contemporary issues. Rabbi Druckman feels he's doing proper conversions. Rabbi Sharman feels he's not doing proper conversions. My gosh, rabbis argue about what Jewish law means. Typically, we should say, these are two different opinions. People who want to follow this view will follow this view. People who want to follow that view will follow that view. Calls for uniformity, for a single consensus standard, run against the grain of halacha in most areas and are to be met by a certain degree of skepticism by anybody who's a regular learner of the Tur and the Beis Yosef and the Mechaber and the Ramah and the Shach and the Taz and the Beis Shmuel and the Chelkas Mechokek. And it's important to understand that in a normative sense. Halacha has been diverse in most areas with no great push for consensus. I think we should resist pushes for consensus.
It's always such a pleasure listening to Rabbi Breit, even when I disagree with him, which I don't tonight too much, but I want to remind him about a line that I heard from him maybe 10 years ago, which I hope can offset some of Dr. Finkelman's pessimism, or feeling that we're pessimistic. We're sort of strange bedfellows. We've been writing together for quite a while. We don't come from the same part of the Orthodox world. And there are areas that we disagree about quite a bit. But we're good friends, and we write great, well, I won't say we write great stuff, but we have a good writing,
stuff, and I put my name on it.
No. The way we write is we prepare different drafts of the same problem, and then we get together and negotiate. And it works. But that's not the only chiddush. At one point, he just, in the middle of a conversation, he says, Amblestein, don't think that I don't have pegged for who you are. He said, I know who you are. You are exactly two niches to the right of me. And that doesn't bother me at all. And that is what we need to encourage. People who can be open and proud of what they are, of what their positions are, and still have collegial relations with other people. And I'm going to come back to this at the very end and show you what I would do to encourage it. I don't think that he meant to paint all of Haredim with one brush stroke, and certainly I didn't mean that there are a lot of tire slashers out there. That was an exaggeration. There would be people in the Haredi community who wouldn't want me speaking for them. There are others in higher places who wouldn't have any problem with it. I know that's true because they called me before to urge me Godspeed. I am puzzled about where some of us are on any comparison between 1983, the reform decision, which she characterized as maybe an irrevocable split, and Dr. Finkelman, your argument, and I think Rabbi Breit as well, that It's the marriage that's the problem, not the assertion of who's Jewish and who's not Jewish. But that's not the stance we took to the Reform movement. And I recall hitting the road and speaking at Federation meetings, as many of my colleagues did, urging them to rethink this because it would be an irrevocable split. And the notion that, well, you know, we can always reconvert them a second time is not what we put forward, and I'm not so sure that we should be satisfied with it at this time, because if you speak to the people affected by it, they don't want to be told, well, it's okay, you can always go to a Haredi Beit Din, and they'll reconvert you, they'll convert you a second time. There are people who want to believe that what they got was a glatt kosher conversion that is not going to be questioned by any large part of the community. I'm not sure I have a solution to that problem. But I think that telling people that it's okay, don't worry, if your kids ever marry Haredi, they can be reconverted. I deal with the agony of people who were converted decades ago, not by any Israeli rabbinate, but by rabbis who in the United States who had different standards. And now they're trying to marry in the community. People are saying, well, was that conversion really a proper conversion? And I don't know what you think the reality is, but the reality is that there are lots of these geirut l'chumra that are going out, but with great pain to lots of people. I maybe could live with it, but only if the original conversion would have been honest and upfront. If you tell people, look, these are the principles upon which we're going to convert you, but realize that a good part of the community is not going to recognize you as Jewish. There at least has to be that much truth in advertising. And, you know, if that's what Tzohar will agree to, I'll back it. But at least that has to be part of the equation. Let me get to the end of this. I think that there's one thing that's happened in the last couple of years that's been a bit of an equalizer. As much as there has been a hardening of position, I think on both sides, the Haredi community and the centrist and certainly to the left, of, you know, we got it right and others are just wrong, and keep out certain information sometimes deliberately and sometimes not from their adherents, there has been an equalizer in recent years, and that's the Internet. In the last Shemitah cycle, just before Shemitah began, some of the older Sfarim on Shemitah were republished. And lo and behold, Rav Shlomo Zalman's argument that I don't like the Het HaMechira, but you should know, bottom line, if they use it, it's completely okay and you can eat the food. Somehow that line was expurgated and removed when they republished it. Terrible thing. I can't stand it. I hate it. I think it's detestable. But I am pretty much willing to bet good money that more people found out about Rav Shlomo Zalman's psak through the Internet than had been denied that knowledge by the quashing of it in the republication of the book. The Internet is becoming a forum for getting information to people about other communities, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, that they would not otherwise have come in contact with. And that's not a small thing. In conclusion, I would urge everybody to think about my proposed remedy, which would be to encourage ways in which the other that you don't like so much, or the other that you detest, but recognize that they're Acheinu Bnei Yisrael, find out more about your own strengths. Find out that their stereotypes of you and them are false. It can be done. There's sometimes a resistance, and I have to throw this in, where are you, Jay? This is something I heard from your uncle, Rabbi Wolf Kelman. He was a major leader of the conservative movement. I spent a weekend with him many, many years ago at Brandeis Bardeen in California. And I spoke to him at the time. He was in the height of the antagonism between the Orthodox world and the heterodox movement over Mi Yehudi. And heterodox rabbis were, especially in Los Angeles, were taking every occasion to talk about the evil Orthodox. They had them once a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That was the sermon on Yomim Noraim. What the Orthodox are doing to say that you're not Jewish, when what it really was, where they're saying that your rabbi is not exactly somebody we would call a halachic leader. And I was looking for ways in which just to get to reform and conservative venues and say, you can call me what you want, I'm here to deliver one message. That's not the way we look at you. You are our brothers and sisters. We have a disagreement with you. There are principles we can't compromise upon you, but you should know we don't have a choice about this. This is part of our Mesorah, and this is part of Halacha. Ahavat Yisrael, we can't agree with everything you do, but deep down we connect with you because you are Jewish. I expressed to Rabbi Kelman the frustration that virtually all doors were closed, because any time I asked for a venue in a Reform or Conservative synagogue, the answer came back always the same way. Really? Sure. We'll be glad to have you, as long as you can guarantee that I will be able to speak in an Orthodox synagogue. Now, I couldn't guarantee that. You can think that that's good or bad, but that's the truth. We're not ready to allow non-Orthodox rabbis generally into Orthodox synagogues and give them the pulpit on a Shabbos morning. When I mentioned this to Rabbi Kelman, he said, "How foolish! I couldn't care less what the Orthodox think about me. If I am comfortable in my position, in my principles, I should be confident enough that I can weather the world regardless of what others think about me. I'm not affected at all by what the Orthodox think of the conservative movement." We should learn from that. I know it's not easy. It requires swallowing pride. That when we're confident about our beliefs, when we do believe, I will say it, I'm a believer in Medinat Yisrael. I spent my time professionally defending Medinat Yisrael. It took a long time to get there. I came from a different kind of chinuch, but I am there today. When I am proud of a certain amount of acculturation, when I believe in openness, when I characterize myself as a Hirschian, then I don't care so much what they're saying about me in other places or in Bnei Brak or all the way to the left. I think that when you're proud of your principles, you can negotiate and navigate some troubled waters and open yourself up to the realities and the strengths of what's outside and what's in different communities, even when they won't reciprocate.
Just before we break, we're going to go back to Rabbi Lau. Since he started, he will finish. Rabbi Adlerstein, I'm going to get back to you about your conservative brothers and sisters a little bit later on. Rabbi Lau has one thing to add.
I will add just one small point. I don't want to argue now with the many points, but I learned a lot from Rav Ovadia Yosef in the last 10 years. I had the zchut to be a bit close to him. And one of the points that I think important, it's not a question that machloket, the argument, is part of the Jewish system. And the Paskim know how to argue with Ahava. But the question is, if the Posek, that big leader, the Posek, feel himself as a slave, servant, I prefer the word slave, to the people, that he is sign himself and identify himself as the one who stands and work for and to the people. You know that we are saying in the tefillah about Moshe Rabbeinu, Ismach Moshe, right? Ki Eved Ne'eman Karata Lo. Eved Ne'eman, it's a servant to whom? Ne'eman, it's a
Ne'eman?
Trustor? Ne'eman? To whom? So usually we think that Ne'eman la'Hashem, Eved Ne'eman, that Hashem gave him the achrayut to bring the Torah to Am Yisrael. But we understand that Moshe felt that he have the achrayut and ne'emanut to the people. And because that, in Chetah Egel, he fight against Hashem and said, Mechenina, Misifricha Asher Katavta. This is kind of leadership that said, no, I am the ambassador of the people. And I want to be Shaliach to help them. This is kind of Ro'e Ne'eman. Ra'aya Mehena, we said in the Zohar. This kind of Shaliach. And we need to follow Moshe Rabbeinu. Rav Kook's son in his letters, Eved Le'am Kadosh al Admat HaKodesh. Rav Kook was a big machmir in the halachic world. Many, many psakim was really chumrot. But his feeling was Eved. Eved Le'am Kadosh. And I want to say, it should be clear that I don't care about machloket. I'm happy with machloket. But when I see rabbis, big rabbis, that keep the Torah inside their own circle and try to cut themselves and rid off the achrayut and try to think that they got the Torah, and the Torah is like something that they need to keep it, and they don't care about the people. We can talk a lot about Ahavat Israel, but we see economic problems, social problems, private problems, family problems, in the Batei Din, with the Agunot, with the Kashrut, with the Shemitah. It's not just question of machloket, Rav Boyd. Machloket beseder. We can live with machloket excellent. But when you see hashkafa that rabbis created to the world and said, I am a rabbi of a sector and I care about my sector and I don't care about the klal. This is something wrong inside, not the halachic world. It's wrong in the Klal Israel world. Halacha is part of that. And I think that, and I learned that from big rabbis. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he wasn't a Tzioni dati, but he was strongly against this sector Ashkafa. Rav Ovadia Yosef is not Tzioni dati. He's aggressive against this sector Hashkafa. And we can mention many others that didn't come from the Tzionidati field. It's not a question of Tzionidati or not. It's a question of feeling of achrayut leklal Israel. And if we see rabbis, sometimes it's not rabbis, but use names of rabbis, who take the halacha and close it to one sector, we should stand and say, Ad kan. It's not because we want to fire, we want to bring the machloket to Am Israel. The opposite is true. We want to save Am Israel and to bring the Torah to the people that Hashem gave them the Torah, and we need to be the shaliach of Am Israel and not take the Torah from Am Israel.
We're going to take a 5-minute break, and everybody can stretch their legs.